Okay, here we go. Stand by.
3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
Couple of quick things before we get started with my guest, Catherine Stewart. First of all, I talked a lot about, and I wrote about in my autobiography, about these Christian apocalypse movies. The Thief in the Night films came out back in the 70s and 80s, just scared me to death, and they scared a bunch of people. And if you look at it now, they just seem so quaint and stupid and horribly produced and laughably bad. But, you know, back then it was heavy stuff, especially for an indoctrinated kid. And I've been thinking about doing it for a long time, and I finally sat down and went through all the films. There's four in the series. I went through them with commentary by me. And those are posted to YouTube. So if you want to go and sort of see what I saw, but look at it through the looking glass the other way, through the eyes of a skeptic, to see me experiencing these films like 40 years later, you can just Google search them, A Thief in the Night, Seth Andrews. I put a playlist up on my Thinking Atheist YouTube channel. It's a ride. I mean, it's weird and it's bad and it's bizarre, but it's also an interesting look at how these Christian apocalypse preachers tried to literally scare the hell out of a generation. And if you're one of those people who was scared by it all, maybe it'll be therapeutic for you to go back and see it again through the eyes of skepticism and reason and rationality and the evidence, and sort of taking a really good look at why it's all just crap and none of it makes any sense scientifically, historically, or morally. There's some good therapy there. It's on YouTube. You can find it. A Thief in the Night, Seth Andrews. Just search it, and I hope you enjoy. So next week's broadcast is going to be show number 500. Can you believe that? 500 shows? I've opened the mic here and done the broadcast 500 times with a litany of guests and topics and subjects and callers over 10 years. It's crazy when you think about it. And so anyway, next week will be that milestone. Of course, you know, we're all sort of quarantined with the COVID thing. We're not doing a big event. I was thinking about how to mark the occasion. Honestly, I think I'm just going to hang out with you guys. And we're just going to do what we do. We'll do what's helped to make the show successful over these past 10 years. But get ready. Show number 500 coming up next week. And thanks so much for being with me. And you know, you're the one who made it possible. Hell, I could sit here and blather on all day and nobody's listening. Nobody cares. It doesn't matter. But you've been right there. And that's huge for me. So anyway, 500. Here we go next week. Most of us staying close to home during these strange and sometimes claustrophobic days. Here's the upside to all this. If you have to be home, it's a great time to discover The Great Courses Plus. They're a longtime supporter of this broadcast. They're one of the best resources for learning I've ever seen. Thousands of lectures from experts in their field that stream right to your computer, your tablet, your laptop, your smartphone with the Great Courses app. You get a primer on viruses, find out how they work. There's a series called An Introduction to Infectious Diseases. You can get a beat on the economy, this wild ride with the economy. They have a lecture called Money and Banking, What Everyone Should Know. You can learn how to filter through all the bogus info out there and find the real stuff with the lecture series Fighting Misinformation, Digital Media literacy. And if you're looking to sort of check out from all this, you can do something else. You can keep the kids learning about math and science and history while they're out of school, or you can check out a new hobby, pass the time, gardening, cooking, learning an instrument, learning a new language. I love the Great Courses Plus. Now's a perfect time to get started. They are giving my listeners a great offer. It's a free trial, and it's only $10 a month when you sign up for a quarterly plan. So sign up today using my special URL to get started. Find all the details at thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/Seth. My guest for this conversation is Catherine Stewart. She is a journalist and an author and a friend, somebody whose work I was introduced to years ago, and I immediately became a fan. We've spoken to each other in the past. It was about the Good News Club, as I recall. Catherine, didn't we talk about that organization? You released a book. It's been 8 years, right?
That's right. It's been 8 years. And that book focused on the religious right and public education. And this is a much broader look at the movement overall.
I got a message from a friend of mine who said that they just discovered a couple of months ago a Good News Club in their schools. This is an effort that is alive and well. For those who didn't hear the old broadcast, can you kind of tell everybody what the Good News Club is?
Sure. Good News Clubs are so-called Bible study clubs, or what they are is really religious indoctrination clubs, and they are installed in large part in public elementary schools around the country. They target children in their earliest years of learning, ages kindergarten through fifth grade, and they confuse little children into thinking that their public school endorses a particular form of the religion. They tell these children in the clubs that they're going to go to hell without Jesus, and they use the sort of exploit their position inside public schools to get children to recruit their peers to the club and to proselytize their peers in public schools, on public school property. And, you know, I was really astonished to discover back in 2009, when a Good News Club came to my kids' public elementary school, I was astonished to discover there's thousands of these clubs operating in public schools. I mean, you know, they're not operating churches or people's private homes or even in parks where, you know, everyone is free to practice their faith, if any. They're operating in public schools. And look, public schools have a kind of cloak of authority in the minds of little kids. They think of something happening in school, it must be what the school authorities want them to believe. So I was astonished that these were happening in public schools, but I also thought they were kind of a relic of the past. And it turns out I was really wrong about that. The more I learned about Good News Clubs in public schools, the more I realized that the effort to put these clubs in public schools was just one part of a much larger attack on public education. And the attack on public education by the religious right is just one small part of a much larger attack on America's modern constitutional democracy.
So how, I mean, is it true that the parents often don't know what these things are, maybe don't even know what's going on? Hey, there's an after-school event. Yeah, I let my kid hang around after school to be a part of it. Was that part of the design of the Good News Clubs?
Right, and it's free. I mean, the clubs do require parental permission to join, but for many parents, they got flyers with pictures of balloons and saying, it's going to be, you know, stories, games, and fun. And they don't realize that they're going to be indoctrinating children into a deeply fundamentalist form of the Christian faith. Many parents are desperate, of course, for a free after-school activity. And they think, how convenient. It's in a public school setting. It extends the school day from 2:30 to 3:30, and I can use that extra hour to work. And in some instances, kids would come home and they'd tell their parents, you know, mommy, we're going to go to hell because we didn't go to the right church, or we don't go to the right kind of church, or we're going to go to hell because we don't go to church at all and we need to join a church. So the idea for a lot of these Good News Club leaders is to get the families through the kids. You get the kids determined to get their parents to, you know, become religious because they're told they're going to go to hell if they don't. And then you get the parents to sort of hopefully join the church.
We're friends. I mean, we can talk like real people, Catherine. I am right now, I'm of two minds. Tell me if you can relate. I'm two people. There's one Seth that is, I'm encouraged at the increasing secularization of the United States. People are less and less interested in religious exercises in their everyday life. They're certainly not interested in legislating, theocracy, the Bible, whatever. So there's that version of myself. And then there's the other version of myself that is just depressed. Because we see the entrenching of power, the Christian nationalists, the fact that we have an evangelical advisory board, and we've got a 24-hour hall pass for people like Franklin Graham and Paula White and Jerry Falwell Jr. And I don't know, do you look at this sort of two shades of the United States and have that conversation in your own skull?
I think that if we're expecting demographics to solve this problem for us, we are mistaken in a country where 40 to 50% of people simply don't vote. You don't need a majority to dominate in a system as politically fragmented as ours. Even small groups, if they're united, can win. You know, in my research over the past 10, 12 years into this movement, I've attended countless strategy meetings, gatherings, summits of the religious right. And I remember one of them, Ralph Reed, who's one of the leaders of this movement, stood up and he said, it doesn't really matter. I'm paraphrasing a bit here, Seth. He said, it doesn't matter what percentage of the population we are. That is declining. All that matters is who show up on election day. All that matters is who turns out to vote. So it turns out that people who are really committed members of this movement, the Christian nationalist movement, vote in disproportionate numbers. That's really all that matters, and they really understand that. So they're so determined to get their people out to vote. And I've got so much to say about that. I mean, I think if you can get people to vote on like one or two issues, you can capture their vote and you can control it. And the leaders of this movement know that. They know that pastors drive votes. And so they make this extraordinary effort to deliver messaging to pastors and to the rank and file. You know, the pastors will persuade their congregations, these are the issues that you need to vote on, you need to care on. These are the so-called biblical values. And those inevitably boil down to, you know, a couple of issues, abortion always, and things like same-sex marriage and stuff like that. But you know what? When these leaders are talking to one another, or when they're talking to their political allies or their funders, they're advocating a really wide range of policy positions. It's not just about abortion and, you know, gay rights. It's about right-wing economic policy. The movement has long allied itself with a sort of low libertarian pro-corporate policy that sets itself against government, you know, largely speaking. They hollow out the social safety net. It's about against progressive income taxes and things like that. They also advocate for certain types of foreign policy. So this hits home the fact that this really isn't a culture war we're looking at. This is really a political movement that advocates for a wide range of changes throughout our society and our legal system, and wants to basically consolidate power and put it in the hands of a new elite.
I'm not asking you to be a sociologist, but you've done a lot of this. Do you think there's an apatheist kind of thing going on? I mean, the fact that people aren't engaged in these discussions about the theocrats, they're talking and thinking about other things. The evangelicals, the Christian nationalists, are kind of counting on them to disconnect, right? I mean, it's not all that. It doesn't matter to me, so it doesn't matter. Do you see some of that?
I do. I think it's really hard, and you don't shy away from it, but a lot of people do. It's really hard to talk about the political aspects of religion without appearing to slight or snub religion. But there really is a difference. And I think that gray area, that sort of fault line, is what makes it so hard for people who are sort of moderates or progressives to really engage with the political aspects of religion. I mean, in the work that I do over and over, I show that this really isn't about religion per se. It's a political movement that wants power. But people constantly conflate my discussion or other people's discussion of this with an attack on religion itself, which really it's not.
So you released an article in, was it the New York Times?
That's right.
Okay, the religious right's hostility to science is crippling our coronavirus response. And then you begin to check your email and all the online, all the social media responses. How's your inbox these days?
It's fantastic. I have. It's really funny. I've been accused of being a demon, a door Nazi, of having no children, no husband, of being a mad squirrel who needs to be put back in her cage, and some other stuff that I'm not going to repeat here. It's really interesting. So first, I want to just summarize the article. This is not an attack on faith. It's really about how there are a number of ways in which the Christian nationalist movement bears some responsibility for the current incompetence in our national response. Look, first and foremost, and this is something you've talked about, the movement promotes an anti-science culture that rejects the evidence of critical thinking, science, and expertise, especially. And that has obviously contributed to our inability to address this crisis in an evidence-based fashion. Misinformation is rife in these hyper-conservative religious communities that we're all in for Trump. And another point, I think this is really key, is that it's becoming incredibly obvious right now. We have a poorly developed collective infrastructure, and that's a consequence of those decades of right-wing economic policy. And the Christian nationalist movement is implicated in that too. The movement has allied itself for many years with libertarian economic conservative wing of the Republican Party. And, you know, they support politicians and policies that have led to the privatization of healthcare and undermining of government everywhere. So when you're always demonizing government and seeking to tear down the social safety net, you're going to have trouble when all of a sudden what's required to deal with a worldwide pandemic is a coordinated government response. And that's another big reason why we're not prepared for this crisis. And, you know, I think it's also worth emphasizing that in the Trump years, we've seen a breakdown of formal expertise and an increasing premium paid for political loyalty and ideological conformity. I don't know if you've been watching the TV at all, Seth, but you see these folks surrounding Trump just praising, a lot of them are just praising him all the time. And they're not in their positions, like, because they're experts in managing the areas that they're meant to manage. They're really there because they, A, hew to this, like, extreme ideology, many of them, and number two, because they display this sort of servile level of loyalty to President Trump. And this is weakening our ability to take, you know, to manage this crisis in the most fact-based way, to bring in the smartest experts who can, you know, manage it from the top, and to care for our most vulnerable citizens, both in their healthcare and economically.
I'm interested, too. You know, you've got Mike Pence. He's a figurehead, but he's supposedly in charge of the crew. He was, anyway, before Trump couldn't stand it and jumped in back into the podium. But, you know, Pence is an evolution denier. And I'm like, how can you be an evolution denier and address an issue regarding a virus? You know, it seems to me just a symptom, a microcosm of the much larger problem. Let's talk a little bit about the loaded language that's used by the Christian nationalists. It's a little bit reminiscent of back when the creationists were trying to get creationism taught in public schools, and they had no traction there and were rebuffed by the courts. And so they got crafty and it became intelligent design and teach the controversy. You know, these sort of innocuous terms that are supposed to represent the curiosity, actual learning, you know, exploring the options. And now, you know, here we have the theocrats, and they've co-opted words like family, family values, the traditional family, religious freedom or religious liberty. I heard Attorney General William Barr using that when he was speaking to the National Religious Broadcasters Association. This assault by the secularists on religious liberty. You've delved sort of into the deep waters of these terms and how they're used by organizations like the American Family Association. Yes?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the call for religious freedom that characterized so much of this activism today, you hear that term over and over. Now, they're undoubtedly bound up in a sincerely held belief, of course, that conservative Christians should be permitted to discriminate against LGBT people and others. So, you know, that's one side of it. They're saying that, you know, it's their religious freedom to not have to treat gay people or unmarried women or people of other faith groups or perspectives or secular people with the same kind of respect they treat others. Now, I think that there's part of that. It's almost like they want to establish a hierarchy of rights because, by the way, there's no religious freedom for people who happen to root their belief in equality in their own sincerely held beliefs. It's like, you know, if I go, for instance, into a Catholic hospital and it is my sincerely held belief that I'm entitled to best practices medicine, I'm not going to get it if whatever I need, like if I need miscarriage management, if that conflicts with the Catholic hospital's ethical and religious directives, they're going to treat me according to their religious bias, and I am not going to be able to access that care. So it is kind of a license to discriminate against others. But there's more to it than that, Seth. I think it's also grounded in the fear among movement leaders that their discriminatory inclinations are going to cost them their lucrative tax deductions and subsidies. And they also want to substantially increase the flow of public funds in their direction. So as you know, religious organizations already obtain public money through subsidies and tax deductions and grants and vouchers and these other schemes. But they want to increase that flow of money. And this is really obvious in the field of public education, where religiously motivated voucher advocates are arguing that public funding of religious schools is a religious liberty issue. And in their view, if you fail to fund religious schools with taxpayer money, that's a violation of their religious liberty. I mean, it's really kind of astonishing. It's completely antithetical to the spirit and letter of the first clause of the First Amendment. But, you know, it goes even farther than that. Like, 8 federal agencies in the last months have proposed changes to the rules governing how they work with religious organizations. So under this specious guise of religious liberty, they're proposing to allow religious organizations that receive these federal funds to fail to comply with anti-discrimination law. So if you're receiving taxpayer money to do a soup kitchen, you can say, well, yes, but we only hire Christians who are leading a so-called Bible lifestyle. And in some instances, when the taxpayer funding is delivered through vouchers or indirect aid, they can even proselytize or require participation in religious services. So in that instance, the soup kitchen could say, we'll give you your soup, but you've got to sit through church service first, or you have to give your life over to Jesus first. It's kind of astonishing.
Talking here with Catherine Stewart, she is author of the new book called The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. We are seeing right now it's shameless. I mean, they're not even maneuvering behind the scenes anymore. Right now, it's an overt assault. And I guess it has been ever since we saw the rise of the moral majority and Jerry Falwell Jr., or rather, actually, Jerry Falwell Jr.'s father. You know, this began actually back in the 60s during the height of the Cold War. I've done some writing about this. I know you've delved into it as well. But, it's overt. We have Project Blitz right now that's going after the court system. We're not just talking about the Supreme Court. You've gotten into Project Blitz. It's weird. A lot of people don't even know who they are or what they're about. So can you give us a primer on that, Catherine?
Sure. The idea behind Project Blitz is that they're going to overwhelm state legislatures with bills based on centrally manufactured legislation. So they'll, you know what ALEC is, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They craft these pieces of legislation centrally, and then different politicians who are, you know, allied with the organization will flood the states with either identical bills or very similarly worded bills. Well, Project Blitz is the same idea. They want to basically chip away at the separation of church and state bit by bit. It's a sort of death by a thousand paper cut strategy, and eventually use the coercive powers of government to secure a privileged position in society for their version of Christianity. So they've divided these Project Blitz bills into 3 different levels, depending on the difficulty of how they will be to pass. So the first layer is stuff that's pretty easy to pass. As one of the Project Blitz leaders said, it's kind of like whack-a-mole for the other side. It'll drive them crazy. They'll have to divide their resources in opposing this. So they often are like appearing as these In God We Trust bills, a bill that says we need to put the, you know, In God We Trust signs in every public school or in every public school classroom or in every public school, every public building in towns or in every, even on police cars, which is kind of amazing. There's, you know, they're even trying to put In God We Trust on police cars. And it's just like slowly the idea is to conflate in people's mind the idea of America as a Christian nation or as a religious nation and sort of chip away at the idea of America as a modern constitutional democracy that's non-sectarian, you know. And then the subsequent layers of Project Blitz are much more, you know, involving religion in government in much more substantial ways, such as the idea of celebrating a Christian Heritage Week. And the third level of Project Blitz are these bills that allow people who possess the so-called correct beliefs to discriminate against others who do not. And this kind of goes back to what you were talking about when you were mentioning Bill Barr. Bill Barr, he's given a really good example of what's driving the movement, and that's a profound hostility to secularism and to religious liberalism as well, which he may well identify as secularism. He definitively blames non-believers, though, for every problem in society. And he not only blames non-believers, but also suggests that they're profoundly beloved, malevolent beings, and this is a central part of the movement today. He's given a couple of speeches, one at the Notre Dame University Law School, and he's written papers about this, saying that secularists are out there ransacking everything that's holy and good in our society and blame secularists for everything, like, from, you know, marriage breaking up to widening levels of economic inequality and this kind of stuff. I mean, it's really so he's got no interest whatsoever in social science or in economics. He's just got this one answer to what's wrong with America today. And that's very emblematic of this movement.
It's interesting, too. I mentioned this several times in the past, to watch people, and I get why they do it, and I'll come to that. But, you know, they can worship whatever religion 24 hours a day. They can pray privately, publicly, attend a church service anywhere at all hours. They can display religious symbols on their personal property, and they can wear Christian apparel, jewelry, tattoos. They can, you know, essentially exercise their religion in almost every personal and individual way, while crying out about persecution and how persecuted they are. And a part of me thinks it functions on two levels. One, I think, you know, Jesus commanded his disciples to be persecuted for his sake. So to be a good Christian, I think some believers have decided, well, I've got to be persecuted in order to be a good Christian. But I also think it's kind of supposed to be a conversation stopper, right? If Bill Barr or Pompeo or Donald Trump or Betsy DeVos or whoever says that we're persecuted, this is supposed to insulate them from criticism. What's that quote? It wasn't Emerson who said, never let me make the vulgar mistake of saying I'm persecuted when I'm merely being contradicted. I don't know. There's a lot to unpack there, Catherine, but what are your thoughts?
I think that this is the way religious nationalist movements always work. There's a we under threat, and there's an insidious internal enemy that's responsible for all of our woes, and they have to be silenced or eliminated if the so-called real Americans are to triumph. This is, you know, hitting home the fact that Christian nationalism is not a stance in the so-called culture wars. It's a political ideology and a movement. It says that what makes the United States distinctive is not our democratic system of government or our constitution. Instead, its representatives insist that the foundation of government in the United States is really bound up inextricably with a reactionary understanding of a particular religion. It basically says the U.S. is founded on the Bible. And think about this, Seth. This is an incredibly radical assertion. This is contrary to what our founders intended. This is contrary to the values that have held our pluralistic and diverse society together, even as so many others have been blown apart by their differences. And, you know, when you look at religious nationalists around the world, this is what they do. When Vladimir Putin in Russia or Orban in Hungary, I don't know if you saw what happened in Hungary yesterday, it's terrifying, or Erdogan in Turkey, bind themselves closely to religious conservatives in their countries in order to consolidate a more authoritarian form of power, we understand that as a form of religious nationalism. And this is what we're seeing today with Trump's alliances with their own religious ultra-conservatives. The religious nationalists don't want a seat at the table in the form of a, you know, noisy form of American democracy. They want to smash the table and replace the system that we have with something different. And I actually think that this leads to why they love Trump. I think that, you know, a lot of people think, well, how could the so-called values voters who purport to care about, you know, morality support someone like Trump, who is, I mean, I don't know where to begin with his, I just
take the antithesis of all of the best teachings of Jesus Christ. And there you
I
have a photo.
I could just take a dart and close my eyes and I'd hit something, right? But, and some people think it's just transactional. They think, oh, he'll enact economic policies favorable to their interests, or he'll, appoint justices that are going to end abortion. But there's more than that. He's not playing by the rules. He doesn't follow the rules. He is a law unto himself. And they seem to long for the hard hand of a despot. If you really want to destroy democracy, you can't have someone who follows the rules. You need someone who's going to violate norms and break the law.
They seem to, it's an authoritarian model, which is common in religion, right? Do you think that the Republican Party in this way, they're kind of kingmakers, right? They brought the king to power, and now they want him to have, sort of support him from behind the scenes so that they can get their way?
I actually think that the religious nationalists have taken over the Republican Party, and which, you know, has left many American Republicans feeling as though they really don't have a political party anymore. I think it's much easier in a way to bind a smaller group around a radical core than it is to unite a broader group with varied interests that is united mostly in its opposition. So I think that that's really what happened. And if you look at the history of this movement, you can see that that was sort of happening from the very beginning. I mean, if you look back about when Paul Weyrich and his friends were starting the New Right, you know, the rise of the New Right is a sort of intellectual movement that played a pretty strong role in creating what we have today, the sort of the religious nationalist movement. I mean, they went down a list of issues at one point. You know, we're talking like 1980, 7 years after the passage of Roe v. Wade. They were looking for an issue that they could use to unite this new movement. And they were really disgusted, by the way, with the Rockefeller Republicans, who they saw as soft on communism and things like that. And they went down the list. First, they thought, they were really upset about the threats to this tax status of groups like Bob Jones University, like a school that was discriminated against black kids and stuff like that. And they thought, well, defending the tax status of segregated schools isn't really going to be an attractive issue for our movement. They looked at the ERA. They were worried about women's rights, but the ERA was already sort of going down in flames. And abortion was like number 5 or 6 on the list. And they came down to that issue, and Weyrich said something like, wow, that could work. So they found this issue around which to unite this very sort of radical movement. You know, Weyrich himself said something to the effect of, we're not conservatives, and that conservative means maintaining the status quo. We are radicals. We want change. We are the forces of change. And I think this movement is radical in its way.
I do have the switchboard open. If you have a comment or question for Catherine Stewart, you are more than welcome to dial in. I have a call here at 641. Hi, you're on the Thinking Atheist podcast. Who's this?
This is Malin Miller.
Thanks for calling. Got a comment or question for Catherine Stewart?
Yeah, it was more of a comment. I hope this isn't just rehashing things that have already been said, but one thing that I really find strange is how religious people seem to be so averse to the idea of a secular government, because if anything, they should push for it just as hard as an atheist would. Because the reason why is because if they didn't have a secular government, then anybody in power could oppress anyone that didn't agree with them. So it would really be up to whatever religious leaders are in power at the time to decide what is religiously acceptable in America by law. So it really opens the door for oppression for both atheists and people of various religious groups. So the fact that there's so many people that are religious that are scared of a secular government, it amuses me. I am an atheist, by the way. Just I didn't state that at the beginning.
I don't know, Catherine, do you have any thoughts on that?
Know.
Do you think in its purest form, Christianity would support a secular government?
I don't think this is about theology at all. I think this is a political movement that wants power. I don't think you can talk about Christianity in its purest form, because there are so many different ways to interpret Christianity. Christianity in America and all over the world is incredibly diverse. This is a political movement that wants power. They want money for, you know, directed taxpayer money directed to their organizations. They want their leaders to have access to political power. And we're seeing that today. I mean, it's interesting. I was looking up the other day. Do you know who Ralph Drollinger is? He runs this group called Capital Ministries, targeting political leaders at the highest echelons of power. So I was looking at his list of what they call, you know, sponsors, capital sponsors at Capital Ministries. He teaches a Bible study group. It's been attended by folks like Pompeo, Purdue, Carson, DeVos. I mean, I think there were like a dozen current and former members of Trump's cabinet who are attending Ralph Drollinger's Capital Ministries. And he has this incredibly hyper conservative theology. And they're all like putting their names and faces, you know, to this and kind of cool with that. It kind of shows the amount of access to power that members of this movement really have. So I don't think this is really about, you know, local disputes and who's going to adjudicate and, you know, we should find something that's fair for all. This movement has set itself in opposition to the values of inclusion and diversity. There's work for this nation since its founding. Imperfectly, of course, but, you know, it's an ideal we can all strive for.
Appreciate your call very much. Thanks for being a part of the show.
Yep, thank you.
All right, take it easy. Let's talk about the Johnson Amendment, right? Donald Trump gets elected, and he's like, one of the first things I'm going to do is wipe out the Johnson Amendment. And it, for those who are joining us who don't know what the Johnson Amendment is, can you sort of nutshell it for us real fast, Catherine?
Sure. The Johnson Amendment is intended to prevent pastors from politicking from the pulpit, that is, you know, endorsing candidates for political office from the pulpit, saying, you know, vote for this person, but don't vote for that person. But, you know, the Johnson Amendment has already been vetoed on the ground because large numbers of America's conservative churches are acting essentially as partisan political cells. And they're not just doing it, you know, at their own behest. They're doing it at the urging of large-scale organizations such as Watchmen on the Wall. Now, let me tell you what that is. Watchmen on the Wall is a network of pastors. They've got at least 27,000 participating pastors. It's an initiative of the Family Research Council, which is one of the leading policy groups of the religious right. So Watchmen on the Wall gets these pastors together. They have gatherings of conservative-leaning pastors, often in swing districts, and they have speakers that get them to understand these are the ways to vote your values. You need to vote, you know, get your congregants to vote their biblical values. And they say, you know, these are the ways to do it. So first thing they do is they tell them, you know, these are the issues that matter most. And it's always, you know, abortion, abortion, abortion. And then there's some other issues too, but abortion is definitely front and center. And then they give them these amazing tools to turn out their congregations to vote their so-called biblical values. They give them these very explicit voter guides. And when you look at these voter guides that are produced by places like the Organization for Family Policy or the American Family Association or the Family Research Council, these voter guides leave no doubt about which way you're supposed to vote in order to vote your biblical values, you know?
They don't use the word Republican, but they're, I mean,
they're clever.
Yeah, they're really clever.
They really, like, you know, try to, you know, maintain the appearance of neutrality. But when you attend those events, and I have attended those events, there's no neutrality whatsoever. And they also encourage pastors to form what they call culture impact teams within their churches. Now, culture impact teams are groups of congregants that the pastor picks who are going to do the politicking, essentially do the politicking for them. They're going to, you know, introduce other members of the congregation to these issues and to these tools and say, look, these are how to vote your biblical values. They actually give them like a guidebook. It's got like 200 pages of material about how to establish a culture impact team within your church. And so the idea is that the pastor can be up there, you know, supposedly politically neutral, but then you've got these people within the congregations who are actually spreading the word about how to vote the right way. And one pastor I spoke to who was involved in this type of initiative, he said, it threads a separation of church and state loophole. He actually called it a God-given loophole. It's like a way to get around the Johnson Amendment. So it's really funny. I went to another one of these events in Chula Vista, California. that was largely for Latino pastors, conservative-leaning Latino pastors. And the speaker said to this, you know, these pastors, he says, when your congregations are asking you about these economic issues, like, you know, he said, what's more important, talking about the minimum wage or talking about life? So the implication is, like, what's more valuable, a few extra dollars or life? So they really even get Latino pastors or pastors in congregations where they have, look, a lot of issues to worry about, economic security, food security, and things like that, but they're still getting them to vote on those one or two or maybe three, you know, core biblical issues.
And that's interesting. You've got the Christian white nationalists who are now pandering to those who have long been oppressed by the Christian white nationalists. That's weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what? This movement is often characterized as a white movement. And I think, you know, for some of the white people in the rank and file, it's like an implicitly white movement, because for them, it's part of a vision that involves recovering a nation that was once supposedly both Christian and white. So it's like a form of identity politics, because it's tying the idea of America to a set of like approved religious identities and cultural identities. But leaders of the movement, they understand demographics as clearly as you or I can. And so they've really sought to bring in recent years, some conservative Latino and Black pastors in the hopes of obviously capturing a certain subsection of the votes of their congregations. And, you know, also because I think they're eager to guard themselves against accusations of racism, but they do paper over the ways, I think, in which hyper-conservative religion and racism can reinforce one another. And they're also very cynically driving support for a culture war that the culture wars that they engage these pastors of color in drive support for a political movement that's engaging in race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression.
It's crazy.
As a strategic imperative. Yeah. So it's ironic.
Let's take a real short break. I've got lots to do still. We've got lots to talk about with my guest, author Catherine Stewart. So we're going to talk about the moderate Christians. How do they feel about all this? So I'm interested in the sort of mindsets around here that God is a capitalist. And, you know, well, he might be. I mean, I don't know, but I want to ask Catherine about that. More of your phone calls. We continue our conversation right after this. My amazing, wonderful, beautiful, lovely, and hugely supportive patrons get this broadcast commercial-free, and they get the show early every single week. If you're a patron, thank you so much. If you're not, consider becoming one at patreon.com/SethAndrews. Talking here with journalist and author Catherine Stewart. She's got a new book out called The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of the Religious Right. And we start this segment by going back to the switchboard and taking another call. I've got 305 on the switchboard. Thanks for your patience. You are on the Thinking Atheist podcast with my guest, Catherine Stewart. Who's this?
Hi, my name is Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Rachel.
Comment or question today?
So one thing that kind of came to mind previously when you were talking about the foundation of this religious movement and how it started to peak in the 60s was the formation of the national prayer meeting or the prayer dinners that they like to do at the White House. That's been a trend since the Cold War. What is really the legality of something like that, since we are a nation that has, well, no sustainable, like no religion under the Constitution? How is it we're able to identify something as a national prayer meeting?
Well, it's true that, you know, Christianity and Christian churches have played a role in our nation, in our founding, and also in, you know, throughout our history. I mean, religion has just been a part of our country as it is part of almost every country for many years. And I think it's worth noting that in some places it's played a very positive role. I mean, let's not forget that there's a large movement of progressive Christians that reject the values of conquest and division that this movement represents. But the hyper-conservative form of religion that we're seeing in religious nationalism today has been implicated in some of the most disturbing, I would say, events in our history. The sort of pro-slavery theologians right before and after emancipation, like the theologians today, the hyper-conservative theologians today, endorsed the idea of the sort of values of biblical literalism, very strict biblical literalism, the idea of American as a so-called Christian nation, hierarchies that are rooted in the Bible, you know, rooted in the Word of God. They still talk about, you know, the hierarchies of male over female as rooted in the Bible. Ralph Dronninger, who I mentioned earlier, he says, oh, it might not be what I want, but it's what God wants, you know, sort of passing the buck. But
yeah, that's convenient, isn't it?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's not
really
about
funny.
Me. Not about me.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. But again, this is like what religious nationalist movements always do, and particularly with regard to the gender hierarchies. I'm sorry I'm going off on a tangent here, but it reminds me of this. They actively cultivate these kinds of sexual anxieties and anxieties around gender. Often these are issues that aren't necessarily coming from the grassroots, but conservative leaders have turned them into defining issues of our time. And they do it in a way to provoke a set of anxieties that can channel votes to their side.
Anything else for my guest?
No, that's all. Thank you so much.
Appreciate you very much. Do you see that he was talking to Fox and Friends? President Trump actually made the admission that reforms for the voting process, especially in the wake of COVID-19, you know, being able to vote by mail and same day registration and doing early voting to greater accessibility than is available now, this actually would hurt the Republican Party, which is one of his reasons to resist it. I'm paraphrasing, but I don't know, are you aware of that?
Yes, and it's really interesting. Paul Weyrich, who I mentioned earlier, one of the leaders of the new right, he actually said, there's a video, you can see him saying it, I don't want everybody to vote. Our influence in elections goes down if the number of votes goes up, or our influence goes up when the number of votes goes down. I actually tweeted this out. It's on video. You can see it. It's like somewhere in my timeline in the last few days. So this has been an idea that's rife within this movement for a very long time. And it hits home the fact that this is a movement that is anti-democratic. They don't believe in equality or the idea that of representative government. They think they seem to have very little respect for the two-party system altogether. And it's interesting. Ralph Reed, again, at one of these events I was at, he was talking very blithely and sort of matter-of-factly about what he called the Republican reapportionment advantage. And he didn't seem bothered by this at all. And he was referring to the fact that thanks to gerrymandering, the elections are gamed for the Republicans. He said, oh, don't worry too much. If the polls are like, you know, if the Democrats are winning by 3 or 4%, we win. If they're winning by 6 to 8%, it's a jump ball. And if they're winning by 8 or more points, then they win. So, I mean, it's kind of astonishing. They're like, he was blithely admitting that they kind of gamed the vote.
Talking here with Catherine Stewart. She's author of the new book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. I was interested in the book. You were talking about the Christian nationalist opposition to a lot of social justice issues. And this is a hot button word, right? When I say social justice, people automatically flip out and divide. And before you know it, they're arguing in comments. But let's look at the best notions of social justice, right? Humanism. Let's call it humanism. And yet there is this weird notion among, I see it here in the Bible Belt, this sort of God is a capitalist way of thinking. Now, I'm not saying that I'm pro-communism or any of that type. I'm just saying, have you noticed the link between God wants the free market kind of a deal? Have you seen some of that, Catherine?
Yes, and I've seen that throughout history. If you look at mid-century figures like James Fifield, who started an organization called Spiritual Mobilization, he brought together conservative theologians with corporate money. Like, he took money from Chrysler and a whole bunch of other, like Sun Oil and some other big companies. And he saw it as his mission to promote a kind of combination of libertarian ideology with conservative religion. And you see this today throughout the movement. If you look at when the movement leaders are talking to their funders or when they're talking amongst themselves, many of them are as or more committed to a kind of minimal government corporate rights vision of economics as they are to right-wing positions in the so-called culture wars. And I think that the culture wars are almost a way to get like the rank and file to vote for these policies that may not necessarily be in their interests. I mean, how do you get members of the working class to vote against shoring up the social safety net?
I was thinking about when I was actually tying together this idea of democratic socialist programs. I'm not necessarily a Bernie guy, but when we talk about Christians who use these types of programs all the time, you know, taxpayer-funded schools, and they drive on infrastructure, highways, and they enjoy taxpayer-funded police. And
a communist plot to have interstate highways.
The fire department is part of a communist plot to try to kill Christianity. And this goes back to the
public
linking.
Public libraries, for sure.
I just I did some writing about this in a book that I have coming out here in a couple of months, where we talked about this linking of communism and godlessness, right? The worship of the state versus the worship of the one true God, which is Yahweh Jesus, how this is rooted back in the mid-20th century, but remains even today. There seems to be among evangelicals this fear of communist Soviet Union, even after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, because communism. I don't know. It's a weird question. I'm not even sure how to ask it. Do you want to speak to any flavor of that?
Oh, my gosh. There's so much to unpack here, and we could go on and on about it. But I want to go right to Phyllis Schlafly, because she's such an interesting person. She was a sort of anti-feminist person. She became a leader in the anti-abortion movement and helped purge the Republican Party of its pro-choice voices, because, as we know, the Republican Party for many years after Roe v. Wade was largely sympathetic to some form of liberalization of abortion law. And there were pro-choice voices within the Republican Party, and she contributed substantially to purging those voices from the Republican Party. But where this goes to anti-communism is that if you read about her in her life, early in her career, it wasn't issues about like women's rights and stuff like that that really animated her. It was her hostility to communism. And at one point she said, if things keep going the way they will, because I think she wrote this in the 1960s, America will be communist by 1973. I mean, she, you know, it's like really kind of frightened of this communist menace. But this has been in existence throughout the sort of world of Christian nationalism. And I think about the mid-century theologian Rusas Rushduni, who was, again, like Fifield. He actually was a big fan of Fifield. He sort of wanted to marry this idea of America's an authentically Christian nation rooted in biblical law with these sort of hierarchies where people who are sort of ultra-conservative Christians would occupy to the top rank, of course. And he was also flipped out by the idea of government assistance to the poor. So I just want to read you a quote that he wrote. He said, "The claim of ownership of the lives of citizens to the humanist state," he called that slavery. I mean, so like the idea that the state, being what he calls humanist, or I should say non-sectarian, if the government is giving people sort of food stamps or housing assistance or helping them with their essential needs should they need them, he called this like a kind of form of slavery. And he said, "In a century's time, the Negro," this is his words, not mine, "in a century's time, the Negro exchanged slavery to an individual for slavery to the state," he wrote. "In both conditions, there are advantages, but both constitute slavery." So he actually saw he was a justifier of segregation. So he was like seemed to be an unabashed racist. And he also is sort of trying to deracialize the context of the enslavement of human beings and saying, well, when the government gives food assistance, that's slavery too. And both are really bad, you know. Well, one is as bad as the other. Well, I don't know. If you can tell me that somehow offering the hungry food stamps is akin to enslaving human beings, know.
And there's also, if I may, a kind of, I call it fear pimping. I mean, fear sells. Fear rallies the troops. You find that, in fact, there is research backing up the fact that people who lean more toward this sort of tribalistic, nationalistic, build the wall type of evangelical Christianity, republicanism, those types of people are often more xenophobic, more afraid of the outsider, more resistant to change. And so, you know, if you've got people who are saying, uh-oh, them, they are coming to take your liberties, your freedom, your safety, whatever, that plays well to a specific demographic, correct?
That's absolutely true. I mean, it's how you build your base. It's entering like a world of the absurd, but that's how the base is built, one paranoid meme at a time.
It's like those guys on Fox News, a commentator on Fox News who was talking about the horde of the mob at the southern border that were going to bring smallpox to the United States, and smallpox has been eradicated. You know, but the threat plays well to that specific demographic. 719. Hi, you are on the Thinking Atheist podcast with my guest, Catherine Stewart. Who's this?
I'm Alex. This is kind of a happy coincidence. I just started reading her book. So,
so
I kind of grew up in the evangelical church. And, like, I left around 2011 when, around the tail end of the first Obama term. And, like, all of a sudden, now that I'm out of everything, there seem to be eight Assemblies of God-affiliated people, like, everywhere. What happened in the last 10 years that, like, has suddenly caused politicians, like, from Project Blitz and all this to suddenly be favored?
Well, if you keep reading my book, you're going to find out.
That's a good answer, yeah.
What chapter are you on?
Oh, actually, I just got past your really harrowing chapter on the pro-life rally, so.
All right. Yeah, well, you know, it's as the deeper into the book, the more you'll see how movement leaders have been favored. And I want to point out that the movement, it's not so much like leaderless, but it's kind of centerless. I mean, there are names that keep popping up in different initiatives, but, you know, it's like the movement is really comprised of a variety of both for-profit and non-profit organizations, policy groups, legal advocacy groups, data initiatives. So it's like a kind of large and slightly centerless movement, but what unites the movement is really a kind of common political vision.
You kind of touched on that with by talking about like those Catholic hospitals, and in a way, these aren't just one single sect. I think you're absolutely on the spot about that. But no, I'm just going to keep reading and find out, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you so much for reading. I really appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
And I really appreciate you. I loved your other book.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, bud. See you later. So you mentioned pro-life, a.k.a. the abortion issue. It's interesting. You said something in The Power Worshippers that the abortion issue really isn't about abortion. Did I read that right? Did I interpret that right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we've bought this narrative that the movement arose as a kind of unified reaction to the horror of a Supreme Court decision in 1973. But that just isn't true, Seth. I mean, the reality is that abortion was consciously selected and cultivated as a political issue. And that happened quite a few years after the Supreme Court decision. And to really understand that, let's look at what was happening around 1973 and just before. Remember that that great conservative hero, Barry Goldwater, actually supported liberalization of abortion law early in his career, and his wife, Peggy, she was a co-founder of Planned Parenthood in Arizona. Can you imagine? And then Billy Graham himself said, in general, I disagree with the Catholic stance. I believe in Planned Parenthood. Now, Billy Graham said that. I mean, at the time that Roe v. Wade was passed, a majority of Protestant Republicans supported some form of abortion law liberalization. Betty Ford hailed it as a great, great decision. Oh, here's another data point. The Southern Baptist Convention, when Roe v. Wade was passed, they had a publication. They published an editorial in which they said this was a kind of sensible middle ground between an absolute ban on abortion and no guidelines whatsoever. But over time, leaders of the movement recognized that they needed an issue in order, leaders of the new right, you know, that we were talking about earlier, Paul Weyrich and his fellows, they needed an issue that was really going to solidify a new movement that was going to essentially revolutionize many aspects of the Republican Party. And over time, they purged the Republican Party of those pro-choice voices. And what we have today, it's almost like we have like a new sort of pro-life religion. You know, it's just on a different order than it ever was in our history.
As we come to the close of our conversation here, in the book you talk, I mean, you hobnob with a lot of like Christians, like moderate Christians, but some pastors mm-hmm. and that kind of thing, right? I mean, you've got...
Oh, I've done a lot of... I just did a conversation with John Fia. He's a professor. He's a progressive Christian. I've done conversations with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, who's with Red Letter Christians. Absolutely.
All right. So how's this playing out with them? Like, they're Bible believers or not?
Of course, they're Bible believers. But there are many different ways to interpret the Bible. I mean, many progressive Christians question whether this movement is authentically Christian in the first place. I'm not going to weigh in there because, you know, I don't have an opinion. I think there are many different ways to interpret the Bible as there are to interpret any other religious text. But yeah, then they reject the politics of conquest and division that the movement represents. And I think it's very painful for them. I did sort of profile some of those folks who are progressive Christians in my book. I also, just by the way, hang out with conservative Christians as well. In fact, after the book came out, I published an excerpt in, I can't remember if it was Religion Dispatches or the Daily Beast, about Jim Doman, who is a sort of, he calls himself an ex-gay. He's a pastor who started one of these pastor networks in California that's determined to essentially, you know, get out the vote for conservative Republican candidates. And, you know, we spoke on the phone for about a half hour after that came out, the excerpt, and he was like, yeah, that's a great piece. I thought that was interesting.
Well, you know, I think it's a healthy reminder that I'm reminded of the website I invoked in some of my writings, ChristiansAgainstChristianNationalism.org, mm-hmm. where there are these evangelical mega pastors like Tony Campolo and some others who were like, look, God doesn't need a Christian nation. You know, God doesn't require this sort of theocratic overrule. Faith is a personal exercise, not a governmental one. And these are prominent pastors, nuns and the Catholic Church, that type of thing. So, I mean, those types of more moderate, more constitutional Christians do exist.
Oh, of course. I mean, I would wager that that's the majority of American Christians in our country. And that, again, hits home the fact that this movement really isn't united by a specific theology. They might call it theology, but I recognize it, and I think many other people recognize it as a form of partisan political agitation.
Catherine Stewart, what do we do now? I mean, we're reading about all of this encroachment, this trampling over the Constitution, this consolidation of theocratic power. We're just, and I become a little bit discouraged. Like, you know, how do you stem the tide? What can we do? Do you have an opinion? I mean, certainly you're an activist. What do you think?
Well, I'm more of a journalist than an activist, but I did write my book because I think that you can't meet your challenges as a society unless people know what's happening. And I wrote, you know, I wanted to really show the inner workings of this movement and to show how they're exploiting religion into a tool for political power and how that machinery is built. And I think once you understand that, you're much better equipped to understand how to respond to it. There are a couple of things that are just, you know, very quickly. I'm seeing more political activism by those who believe in the Constitution, want to affirm the values of equality, want to affirm our constitutional principles. I'm seeing more of that today than I've seen in some time. I think people are, you know, I think around 2016, there were a lot of people who thought, oh, my vote doesn't matter. Why should I bother to vote? I think you're going to see a lot less of that this time around. Of course, under the circumstances, we'll have to see how all that plays out. But I think we're seeing a lot less political apathy than we used to. And, you know, I look at what the religious right does, what they've done that has sort of worked to their advantage. They create a positive voting culture. They make you feel like no matter how old you are, how disabled or whoever you are or wherever you're living, your vote really matters. And I think if we could sort of embrace those values as well, that would be really helpful. They've invested over the years in data, media, and messaging. And there's no reason why believers in the Constitution can't invest in those types of initiatives as well. The right understands the necessity, the absolute imperative of unity when necessary. You know, instead of devolving into these like ridiculous squabbles over, you know, detail number 14.65 of somebody's, you know, endless healthcare plan, like, let's just figure out who is going to appoint better Supreme Court justices, who is going to appoint better people to run the cabinets, who's better qualified to run the government. You know, there's nothing, none of this both sides. You're like, this is not a both sides moment.
I think, you know, for me, it's come down to who more represents my values as a humanist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people sometimes get upset because we talk politics, and I'm like, look, the line between politics and religion was blurred, actually destroyed long ago. I mean, politics and religion, these two are in bed with each other more with one specific party than another. So, I mean, we can't, if we're going to attack superstition and the abuse of power by a specific religion, we have to talk politics, don't we?
Well, I don't even think it's about, you know, superstition or faith. I really think it's about pluralism and equality. And if you support the values of pluralism, that you have, you know, equal value under the law and equal rights under the law, whether you're a secular or a religious, that you don't want to be allowed to be discriminated against by people who hold the supposedly correct religious beliefs that are being promoted all the time, you know, by our White House as official policy, then I think that, you know, choices then become quite clear.
Catherine Stewart, she's author of the book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. It's an honor to talk to you. I love your work. I'm so thankful.
Thank
you're
you.
Out there journalisting and authoring and speaking out, and we'll continue to follow what you're all about. And I'll put a link to your book in the description box of this show, okay?
Thanks so much. It's really great to speak with you again.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming Freethought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.